we along the river bear the brunt of the conservation burden. And we're criminalized for pursuing our way of life.
The debate over the pollock industry's effect on salmon returns. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 21st of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, unsafe mercury levels hamper Juneau's harbor reconstruction project.
We have a duty, really, to go in and make sure that what we do does not harm anybody in town or the environment in Juneau.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
An independent investigator has found evidence that Governor Sarah Palin may have violated ethics laws by accepting private donations to pay her legal debts. The report, obtained by the Associated Press, says Palin is securing unwarranted benefits and receiving improper gifts through the Alaska Fund Trust. Anchorage attorney Thomas Daniel investigated the issue for the State Personnel Board. In his July 14th report, he writes there is probable cause to believe Palin used or attempted to use her official position for personal gain. He says an ordinary citizen facing legal charges is not likely to be able to generate donations to a legal defense fund, but in contrast, Governor Palin is able to generate such donations because of the fact that she is a public official and a public figure. He also says the state should consider coming up with an ethics provision that allows for legal expense funds like those that govern members of Congress. The ethics complaint was filed by Eagle River resident Kim Chatman shortly after the fund was created in April, alleging Palin was misusing her official position and accepting improper gifts. The practical effect of the ruling on Palin will be mostly financial. The report recommends that Palin refuse to accept payment from the defense fund and that the complaint be resolved without a formal hearing before the Alaska Personnel Board. The fund was established to help Palin pay off debts stemming from multiple ethics complaints against her, most of which have been dismissed. Palin says she owes more than $500,000 in legal fees, and she cited the mounting toll of the ethics probes as one of the reasons she is leaving office. Alaska Fund trustee Kristen Cole says the fund was thoroughly vetted by numerous attorneys from Alaska to the East Coast. The State Department of Law will not confirm the report exists, and a spokesman says if it has been released, it is a violation of the law. A fishing protest by a group of Marshall fishermen late last month is the latest development in an ongoing conversation in Western Alaska about the relationship between the high seas pollock fishery, regional development groups, and subsistence fishermen. From KNOM in Nome, Jesse Zink reports.
In late June, fishermen in six boats from the Yukon River village of Marshall intentionally took 100 king salmon after the subsistence season had been closed. Nick Andrew Jr. was one of those fishermen. He blames commercial fishing in the Bering Sea for declining Chinook returns.
The pollock trawl fishery can basically waste salmon without consequence. However, we along the river who rely on this precious resource for subsistence and our well-being bear the brunt of the conservation burden. And we're criminalized for pursuing our way of life.
The Bering Sea pollock fishery is a $1 billion-a-year industry, and king salmon are part of its bycatch. Bycatch rates have fluctuated wildly in recent years, from a record high of 120,000 in 2007 to less than 20,000 in 2008. Biologists estimate that about half the bycatch was destined for Western Alaska waters. A portion of the catch limit is given to community development quota groups to help develop coastal villages in Western Alaska. One group is the Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation, based in the Nome region. At a series of community meetings NSEDC held in the region this spring, Chinook bycatch was the top issue of discussion. NSEDC is well known throughout the region for the millions of dollars it funnels towards small business startup, vocational training programs, scholarships, and infrastructure development. But NSEDC's fisheries research director, Charlie Lean, says his company couldn't do anything without pollock.
We own allocations of many different fisheries in the Bering Sea, Pacific cod, halibut, crab of different sorts. Pollock is our bread and butter, if you will. It accounts for a high percentage, more than half of our revenues from fishing.
the relationship between pollock and king salmon has received a lot of high-level attention from the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council in recent years. The council shapes federal fish policy for Alaskan waters and is moving forward with a Chinook bycatch limit of about 50,000 that should be law by the 2011 fishing season. Lean says he thinks it will provide the right combination of incentives to pollock fishermen.
Most boats will fall well below the 47,500 performance standard, their little piece of that. But one or two boats are going to have difficulty. You know, they're going to be the unlucky ones that go out first and accidentally set on the Chinook, and they're going to, oh, darn, you know, and they'll have to run away from that site. But that's how the rest of the industry knows where not to go. If your sector, you know, say catcher processors or CDQ exceeds their piece of that pie, they're shut down for the season. So this is a fair-sized club, and it's got some nails sticking out of it.
But the North Pacific Council's move doesn't satisfy everyone. Unalakleet fisherman Art Ivanoff says the pollock industry has too much influence on the decision-making process. He's asked Senator Lisa Murkowski to consider amending the Magnuson-Stevens Act to include four tribal representatives on the council.
And it just seems like the council sort of was laid back and trying to prevent this crisis from developing. And I think that's basically why we're calling for seats on the council, is to have members that could voice concerns and vote in opposition of what industry is asking for.
On the other side is the pollock industry. Brent Payne is the director of United Catcher Boats, the industry's lobby group. He says there are numerous stakeholders that influence the North Pacific Council's decision, and he thinks four seats on an 11-member council is too many for Native representatives.
If you added four, they would basically be able to block anything that would go through. It would change the dynamics of the council, probably, and I think that the stakeholders from Washington would feel threatened, I think, by that. So you got to ask yourself, why would you want to put that many tribal representatives on the council?
Left unanswered in the debate about bycatch limits and representation on the North Pacific Council is how CDQ groups like NSCDC balance their income from the pollock industry with their responsibilities to the subsistence fishermen they represent. NSCDC's Lean says his organization is committed to its region.
Our CDQ group and most of the other CDQ groups, our constituency, if you will, is local. We represent the people of the Norton Sound region. The idea is to make life and business viable in the region. We wouldn't cut our own throats. I think when we understand the numbers, I think people will understand that what was done at the council was well-intentioned and will be effective.
The chair of the North Pacific Council is Eric Olson, who also works for the Yukon Delta Fisheries Development Association CDQ group. He declined to comment. Governor Palin declined to comment on the story, citing the ongoing investigation in Marshall, and numerous members of her administration did not return phone calls. Meanwhile, wildlife troopers and the Fish and Wildlife Service are wrapping up an investigation into the Marshall Fish protest. Protest leader Andrew says they've made their point and look forward to the ongoing region-wide discussion.
We went out to get the attention of the system, and we've got it. We're fighting for our people. We cannot allow big business and an unsympathetic state government in Alaska to further dictate our traditional ways of life.
Reporting from Nome, I'm Jesse Zink.
Alaska senators failed to block cuts to the F-22 Raptor fighter jet program today. On a vote of 58-40, the Senate approved an amendment to the Defense Authorization Bill that cuts funding for seven F-22s. President Obama and Defense Secretary Robert Gates did not want the additional fighters and said defense money could be better spent elsewhere. The jets would have come with a price tag of $1.75 billion. That didn't stop Democrat Mark Begich from voting to fund new F-22s, which he supported from his seat on the Armed Services Committee. He says today's vote won't immediately affect Alaska. Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage is home to two squadrons, but Begich says the proposed jets would not necessarily have ended up there.
It has no impact to Alaska in the sense of what we have currently up there. The House version has F-22 funding in there. The Senate version would have been a little more money, more resource. So in conference, we'll have to battle this issue and deal with it. But, I wanted to be consistent, but also it was important to make the statement about the F-22s, and Alaska has benefited a great deal from them.
Elmendorf is in the process of retiring F-15 fighters, and within the year will only have F-22s on base. Senator Lisa Murkowski says today's no vote on building more F-22s might eventually impact Alaska. It may signal a trend of cutting down on the fighters. Murkowski says she also cast her vote in favor of more jets for national reasons.
It truly is an issue where, as we focus on our defense and our assets that provide for our defense, that we make sure that that which we have, we're able to really continue to operate and maintain. We take down the production line of the F-22, and our ability to provide for instance, the maintenance, the backup parts for these aircraft, is limited.
Today's vote was seen as a victory for the White House, and most Democrats sided with the president. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, more illegal immigrants in the region face deportation.
ICE places a priority on the removal of illegal aliens who have criminal records in this country in addition to being here illegally.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Chena Hot Springs is drilling a new geothermal exploration well. The resort is already powered by a 165-degree water, and the new project is aimed at finding hotter water for large-scale power generation by going deeper underground. Resort owner Bernie Carl says drilling is expected to speed up now that they're past groundwater level.
We're down 1,000 feet, and we're waiting for a blow-off preventer to get in here, which will be in here on Tuesday. When it's here, we'll go back to drilling and drill on down to 3,000 feet. We're open-holing now with a 6-inch hole, so it'll go pretty fast.
If the right conditions are present, primarily 200-degree plus water, the resource could support a major geothermal power generation project. Carl says he's working with the Air Force to potentially help Eielson meet a renewable energy mandate.
They have a mandate to have 20% of their energy has to be renewable by the end of 2010. The vision is to be able to take 10 megawatts of energy to Eielson Air Force Base in perpetuity at a half cent under avoided cost.
The project would require new transmission lines, and Carl says low-cost green power would help all Golden Valley Electric customers by displacing more expensive oil and coal-fired energy. The U.S. Department of Energy is a 50% partner in the $1.5 million exploration well. The Juneau Assemblies heard about a plan this week to deposit 30,000 cubic yards of sediment from Douglas Harbor into Gastineau Channel. It's part of the city and borough's $3.5 million harbor reconstruction, but tests show that Douglas Harbor's sediments exceed safe mercury levels by 400%. KTOO's Rebecca Shear has the story.
These days, a 45-year-old person probably has a whole lot of life ahead of him or her, but the 45-year-old Douglas Harbor float system?
It's got to the end of its useful life, and it doesn't have much time left in it.
CBJ Port Director John Stone says the old float system is giving all sorts of grief.
It's falling apart, sinking, you know, and it becomes sort of a safety issue for patrons because during the winters, you know, we have to get over here as fast as we can when it snows because the floats start going underwater.
Douglas Harbor was originally 14 feet deep, but thanks to something called glacial or isostatic rebound.
The ground surface is rising in Juneau because we had a lot of ice, and in recent geologic times that ice has left the ground basically coming up.
The harbor is now a mere 10 feet deep. So before CBJ can install new floats, it must remove roughly 30,000 cubic yards of bottom sediment. That's enough to fill 10 Olympic-sized swimming pools, or 270,000 average-sized wheelbarrows.
And scraping that bottom down is what's known as dredging, which is regulated by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And what they require us to do is see if that dredge material has any contaminants in it.
It's all part of the Corps of Engineers' permitting process. CBJ tested the harbor sediment for contaminants in spring 2007 and submitted the results to Rich Jackson, regulatory project manager with the Corps in Anchorage.
And the information indicated that potential contaminants were below screening levels with the exception of mercury.
CBJ plans to dump the mercury-laced spoils in a 110-foot-deep area of Gastineau Channel. The half-million-dollar plan is the cheapest of the dozen options CBJ has brainstormed. The costliest involves barging the spoils to an Oregon landfill. with a price tag of $7.5 million. That's more than twice the estimated cost of the harbor reconstruction itself.
You know, one option is the no action option. Just don't proceed, and the results of that are you eventually will not have use of that portion of the harbor. We're trying to make the best decision on the preferred alternative, what you also call the least environmentally damaging practicable alternative.
CBJ's preferred alternative would deposit the spoils into the channel's primary vessel travel lane near the Juneau sewage treatment plant. The Corps approved this spot for other deposits in 1999 and 2002, but this time, it's different.
What we do have at this particular location is the mining activities that took place that we think probably are the source of the mercury in this case.
Brett Walters, an environmental specialist with the Corps, says mercury can naturally occur in mine tailings, but
this is sort of my hunch, I guess you'd call it. The process of separating the gold from the rock is actually a greater source of the mercury.
As most of us have heard by now, overexposure to mercury can damage the nervous system of unborn babies and developing children. The Food and Drug Administration and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services have developed consumption guidelines for certain varieties of fish. But the health department has not found cases of unsafe mercury levels in Alaskans who've consumed fish from local waters. And that's why CBJ Port Director John Stone believes mercury contamination in Gastineau Channel is a non-issue.
It's a very small area we'll be impacting. It's roughly a little over an acre. And we don't think there's enough fish typically harvested in this area to really be in that area long enough to really uptake much mercury at all, if any.
Granted, Stone isn't dismissing mercury's potential dangers.
We have a duty, really, to go in and make sure that what we do does not harm anybody in town or the environment in Juneau.
But he is raring to go with this harbor rebuild.
I'm hoping to get a permit soon. Hoping to get something done soon.
And he suspects Juneau isn't the only community eager for such action.
Because the state did really good in the 60s and 70s in building new harbor facilities, and then really not much happened for many, many years, so they're all at the end of their life cycle.
And when you're dealing with harbors built in artificially created moorage basins, like so many in Southeast, eventually you need to dredge. What's fortunate, Stone says, and the Corps' Rich Jackson and Brett Walters agree, is that Alaska's lack of heavy industry has limited the variety of pollutants in bottom sediment.
Like in our case, we have one contaminant that just sort of sticks out. Everything else is clean. So we're not dealing with the whole range of contaminants that have combined effects, and then it's very difficult to figure out how to handle that stuff.
But if the Corps of Engineers rejects CBJ's plan for how to handle this stuff, that could be very difficult, too. The Corps is expected to solicit public comment on the issue later this summer before deciding whether it will issue a permit. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
Deportations of illegal immigrants in the Pacific Northwest are up this year compared to last year. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials say the amount is greater by 10% over last year's numbers. APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports.
The Pacific Northwest area includes Washington, Oregon, and Alaska. The 10% increase reflects overall removals, criminal and non-criminal. Lori Dankers is a public information officer with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE.
ICE places a priority on the removal of illegal aliens who have criminal records in this country in addition to being here illegally. And because of that priority that we place on them, the removals of those individuals are up pretty significantly. In fact, if you compare the statistics from the first 9 months of the current federal fiscal year to all of last year, we're seeing an increase of well over 45%.
She says whether felony or misdemeanor, the type of criminal behavior does not matter.
It can be either. If they are encountered in the criminal justice system, it is enough to have a conviction for a misdemeanor to be removed from the country. You know, ICE has a responsibility to carry out the removal of any individual who is illegally in the United States. But with that being said, we do place a priority on those individuals who have criminal histories here.
Dankers attributes the jump in removals of illegal aliens to ICE's enforcement program.
We have a very active criminal alien program, which is where ICE
Northeast has agents who are responsible for interviewing the foreign-born at local jails, state facilities, federal facilities. And if we find that someone is illegally in the country, they place a hold on that individual, which essentially means at the conclusion of that individual's criminal sentence, they come into ICE custody. They have an opportunity to go before an immigration judge who ultimately determines whether or not that individual will be allowed to remain in the country.
For the first 9 months of the federal fiscal year, October through June, more than 8,000 deportations originated from the Pacific Northwest. That compares to 7,345 in the same period last year. Illegal immigrants with criminal records now make up the largest share of the region's total deportations. Dankers says ICE does not have numbers specific to Alaska. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
Marine Highway officials have not decided how they'll use $3 million in federal stimulus funds allocated to Hoonah's ferry terminal, but they say the grant will help move forward a $9 million renovation of the Northern Southeast Village's marine and shoreside facilities. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Ferry officials asked for more money than they got from the stimulus program, so they're still assessing which parts of the project they'll be able to complete. Ferry Chief Jim Beadle says the money could fund rebuilding the terminal's transfer ramp, which can be dangerous in the winter.
The Hoonah Ferry Terminal Dock is one of the old transfer bridges that is solid steel. And when you get our wet snow, it just compacts and it gets pretty slippery, especially when you've got a low tide. Most of our new transfer bridges are all those square steel holes so that when you know, the snow falls on them, it just falls down and through the water. And the vehicle's got good traction all the way. So all the terminal agents need to do then is just clear off the sidewalks where the people walk. That's much safer for us.
The money also may go towards repairing or replacing pilings, dolphins, or other parts of the marine facility. Officials asked for $4.8 million from the federal government. The $3 million grant is being matched by about $600,000 from the state. The decision on which of the work will be done will be made soon. Beadle says the stimulus project could go to bid this fall and must be completed by February of 2011. The money comes from a $60 million program announced by the Federal Transportation Department. The Marine Highway is already planning about $4.4 million in other Hoonah terminal repairs. Beadle says that work will go to bid this fall.
What we have been working on is shoreside improvements, an expanded parking lot, a new terminal building, additional staging lane and parking for vehicles so when they come over to Juneau and ride the ferry, they have a place to leave their vehicles.
That money came from a separate federal grant. It was awarded to the city of Hoonah, which turned the project over to the ferry system. Hoonah is about 40 miles west of Juneau on the northeast part of Chichagof Island. The ferry, other boats, and small planes are the 800-person village's only transportation link to the outside world. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
In his second story on the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage, KSKA's Len Anderson looks into the cultural philosophy that underlies the center's educational programs for young Alaska Natives.
On a typical summer's day, cultural education seems to be taking place in every nook and cranny of the Alaska Native Heritage Center. Tourists listen to youthful summer employees who are explaining various cultures, while other visitors watch interns working on sewing projects and talk to the teachers. This afternoon, on a side bench to the left of the stage, mentor Edward Tiulana is quietly teaching traditional string stories to young Dea and his even smaller sister, Erin.
And so this is where the house that people live in during the wintertime.
I want to see him go away.
You want to see him go away?
Yeah.
Ready? Let's see. And then the people move out, and they go to hunting grounds.
At the Athabascan cabin site, first summer intern Andrew Dementif, whose family comes from Holy Cross, pauses between visitor clusters.
They're definitely trying to focus the culture, the traditions. They're trying to focus more on the youth now so we can carry it on, keep our tradition alive.
Andrew is speaking of newly learned skills and old days knowledge. Helen Koenig of Sitka teaches interns how to make traditional pre-contact tanned hide tunics. Besides learning to sew clothing, she sees another tradition being taught.
They are learning that they can achieve anything they set their mind to. That's the only way I can explain it. They really feel comfortable trying out the different things. They don't feel like they're being forced to do something. They're doing something that they find out they enjoy doing. And I think they're going to be passing it on to their children and grandchildren.
Marge Nyakuk from St. Michael, who teaches skin sewing, says the students are also learning about themselves.
Emerson, after he started, he is really proud of what he's accomplished today, and he's really impressed with what he has come to learn how to do. And Jeremiah over here is very impressed with the way that he has finished his projects and see how wonderfully made they are, and he did it. And that's a great pride that comes with this process of learning to sew.
But at the Alaska Native Heritage Center, self-esteem and pride carry a different meaning than they do in the general culture. Ethan Pettigrew, vice president of the center's cultural and educational services, says the words don't quite capture the desired Native goal.
Maybe in English it's not there exactly, because self-esteem often becomes an individual thing and often at the expense of criticizing others or being able to say, I'm good, even to the point of I'm a little bit better. I know this and this person doesn't. Maybe a better word would be called cultural self-esteem.
As the young people learn traditional skills, they are never pitted against each other, as is common in Western-style learning situations. Pettigrew says that non-competitive approach fits with traditional Alaska Native societies.
It was frowned upon to, for lack of better words, beat your own drum. Even to a large extent today in our villages, it's very communal, cooperative. In order for our people to survive, we had to cooperate with one another.
Pettigrew says it's that feeling of a traditional community that the center seeks to foster.
From the CEO all the way down to the greeter at the door, we are all in this together, and we continually try to tell our young people we're a community, we're a family here.
As the young people master various traditional skills, their self-esteem and confidence grows. But if the center is truly successful with its educational program, that newborn pride will follow an old pattern. Namely, that the Alaska Native interns experience the ancient satisfaction that they can offer those skills to serve their family, community, and culture. This is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Jesse Zink in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rebecca Shear and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Guess who teens say is their most important influence when it comes to sex? Their parents. Listen up. Teens want to know what you think, even if they don't act like it. Talk with your teens about sex, love, and values. Nationwide, one out of every three girls gets pregnant at least once by age 20. Make sure your daughter isn't one of them. Visit stayteen.org for special parent tips and more information on how you can prevent teen pregnancy. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.